If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
Only the best run here at the Indianapolis 500.
Mario, who do you feel you'll have to beat in this year's race?
People like A.J. Foyt and Bobby Unser, for instance.
Stand by for the checkered flag.
Absolutely incredible. Danny Sullivan spun in front of Mario Andretti.
A.J. has done it. He has won his fourth Indianapolis 500.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store. On 93.5 and 107.5, The Fan.
Inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center, it happens. Hire Hensley. My name is Jake Query. Mike Thompson here as well. Landon Coons is the man that puts it all together for us. As you hear, as we are now midway through the month of May and inside of just 2 weeks, inside of that actually, before the 110th running of the Indianapolis 500-mile race. Tonight, it's a unique evening because, yes, this is May the 15th. And each year, I always say when it comes to May the 15th, I reflect upon and think about, and I don't know why it is. There have been a number of drivers who have been fatally injured at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, but I think the one accident that, visually speaking, is the most haunting is that of Gordon Smiley. And then 10 years after that, it was on May 15th when a young driver by the name of Jovi Marcello was fatally injured at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. And there have been obviously others, but that have passed tragically in the pursuit of the ultimate racing prize. But we certainly reflect upon those two men on this day on May the 15th and are aware, as I think of each and every year when I see that date. I also know, Mike, that for you, you remember May the 15th probably with somewhat mixed emotion because of the somber nature of the Gordon Smiley aspect, but also it was the day that you first walked in and felt that energy that everybody feels when they come underneath the tunnel and enter the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Oh, I agree 100%. I mean, it was my first day at the Speedway. And like you said, it was definitely mixed emotions because, you know, the Gordon Smiley crash happened, you know, basically in front of us. But, you know, you can't really describe the energy of 1982. It was just, it was so big. And and being there with all those fans for qualifications on the first day, it really was truly special. And I always remember May 15th as my first day at the Speedway and finally reflect on that day. So it's exciting to be on the air tonight on May 15th.
Now, 1972, that was the year that greatness would happen in Indianapolis. That was the year right off of 16th Street where this city and its landscape would forever change. Because in September of that year, I was born at Methodist Hospital. But in reality, I was not. I would have been in utero for the 1972 Indianapolis 500. So 73 was the first year that I was living. But the 72 race was one that had so much that took place that even though, Mike, this is not a year on a round number, it's the 54th anniversary of 1972, but nonetheless, we're going to bring that race back into life, and we're going to do it tonight.
That's right, Jake. Now, sometimes I fall into the cliches. I'll do the, you know, since this is year ending in a six, I'll do a bunch of different sixes, and then we do the 25th anniversary. But I thought I'd give you something special tonight, Jake, and give you the 54th anniversary of 1972. So I went completely off the board for this.
Well, nothing wrong with that. We like going off the board from time to time, right? And here's
right.
The thing. You did it sometimes, and you did that math of 54 years. You did that in your head in, like, record time, record speed, right? Which was a theme in 1972, because when you think about it, that was a time period where speeds really jumped up, Mike.
That's right. I mean, speed was the story of the month in 1972, because in 71, you got to remember the qualifying record for four laps was just under 179 miles an hour. I think it was 178. 696 or something like that. And then in 1972, with the rear wings and all those things, the changes and things like that that were going on in tire technology and aerodynamics, the record jumped by 17 miles an hour. Can you imagine that? The record jumping 17 miles an hour in one day, it just boggles my mind.
Bobby Unser sat on pole at 195.940 miles an hour in 1972. Speedway historian emeritus Donald Davidson on that qualifying speed and the record speeds in 1972.
The other thing was the speeds just skyrocketed, because after McLaren had been allowed to use the trick rear wing that was molded into the engine cover for 1972, the huge bolt-on rear wings were permitted for the first time, and probably a little more caution should have been exercised because the teams were allowed to put huge wings on. The downforce was massive. And the track record had gone from 171 to 179. And then in 1972, they went all the way through. In fact, Bobby Unser, I think, did two laps at 196. So they went up 16, 17 miles an hour in 1 year. And not too, you know, approximately 25 miles an hour in 2 years, which was pretty scary. And because it changed the handling characteristics. I mean, it's just a whole different technology came into the mix. And the drivers were pretty much on edge having to go that much faster. Bobby Unser won the pole, four lap average of 195.9, I think, and a couple of laps at 196.
And again, it would be nearly a half a decade before Tom Sneva would eclipse the 200-mile-an-hour mark in qualifying. But that huge jump in 1972, a big portion of that, a big responsibility for it, was that constant innovation of Dan Gurney. Dan Gurney, of course, coming out with that 72 Eagle and the All-American Racers. Bobby Unser was one that loved working with Dan Gurney on that. Loved it, as he would say. And he talked to Mike in an interview about exactly that.
Well, it wasn't just the rear wings. It was a different concept of how to build race cars. That was in 1972. And what happened is Roman Slobodinsky, that's a hard name to pronounce, but Roman was a good engineer. And Gurney, of course, extremely smart guy. Not a good businessman, okay? But really good with race cars. I mean, you just can't imagine. He was a Roger Penske of that era. But he was also an engineer. He's also a mechanic and a hell of a good race driver. So when I took that job over, I really was at the forefront of the entire world. And that car in 1972 caused the entire world in motor racing to change, even to the stock cars. They started changing their concepts of where the weight should be, where this and that and the other should be, the height of the cars, the center of gravity, and all of that type of stuff just changed. And it changed overnight.
Bobby Unser and Bruno Mars, by the way, there with Mike Thompson. Mike, one thing, as we'll continue to hear from Bobby Unser, that needs to be said, I shouldn't say that actually, it doesn't even need to be said, but it is factual, and that is that those that were fortunate enough to meet Bobby Unser, which is the vast majority of race fans because of his accessibility, in particular in his post-racing career, there just was nobody like him.
Oh, I agree. I mean, he was so accessible, easy to talk to. I have a lot of memories that I could share of Bobby Unser spending time with him. He was just an incredible person to spend time with, and just he would needle you if he barely met you, you know, and it was just a lot of fun to be around Bobby Unser. And that interview actually was at the late great Grindstone Charlie's in Speedway, I believe. That's where I conducted that interview. So it was just a lot of fun to spend any time you could with Bobby Unser.
Well, Bobby Unser loved that 72 Eagle that we mentioned, which was obviously an incredible race car, and incredible comments here from Uncle Bobby.
Well, actually, the 72 car had a super, super good record, because it would have, should have, set on the pole every race that it ran that year. In fact, every place that it qualified, it broke a record. It was a new record, boom, 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 all year long. And the car was just too unbeatable, just unbeatable. So it didn't make any difference. It was the record. We won four races. Well, I used to tell everybody, we won every race we finished. unfortunately, we didn't finish all the races. And that hurt us pretty bad because our reliability wasn't too good. The car was so fast that it was just braking pretty often. All engine problems. In fact, I don't even think I ever wrecked that car. And it was just such a fun era to drive because no matter what, it set new records. And no matter what, if it finished, it's going to win the race. Nobody can beat that car all year. And it was just so much fun to drive. And then all the Eagles after that were like little eaglets that got reborn, slight minor changes. Basically the same car, basically the same answers. Always fast, always just fly. The Eagle used to fly.
You know, I'll be honest with you, Mike. My middle school basketball team, we were the Eastwood Eagles. The cheerleaders were the Eaglettes. Very similar to those cars, right?
I would think so. I mean, Uncle Bobby, one thing you have to say about Uncle Bobby, he was a storyteller, wasn't he? I mean, the little Eaglettes, that was good stuff.
The best. And, of course, that characteristic, that unique delivery that Bobby Unser had would become a mainstay with ABC. Boy, come to here, turn two wide open, Paul, as we heard for so many years once he made the move to ABC television after his racing career. Speaking of ABC, we have some clips from the 1972 month of May from ABC television, rare clips as a matter of fact, including this one with Jim McKay and Jackie Stewart discussing the increase in speeds in 1972.
And sitting with me, and we're very proud to have him with us again this year, as we did on race day last year, is the world champion race driver, Jackie Stewart of Scotland. Jackie, the speeds are incredible here this year. 17 miles an hour faster than the pole position of last year. It's an area nobody's really explored before. What's your reaction to it?
I think I've never been so surprised by speed, Jim. I think we always expect speed to increase every year. We expect lap records to be broken, but never by the margin that we're seeing this year at Indianapolis. The Bobby Unser effort is something unbelievable. I think technologically it's been a year of great advance. It's been a great year of tire development. It's been a great year of aerodynamics. It's been a great year of engine horsepower. And apart from anything else, it's been a great year for drivers because some of the drivers really are excelling themselves.
1973, of course, a year later would be one that was marred by all kinds of tragedy and trouble at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. 1972 was not immune to that. Jim Malloy is a driver that was attempting to qualify or hoping to qualify that year for his fifth Indianapolis 500. But he was involved in an accident on May 14th that would prove fatal on May the 18th. Donald Davidson on Jim Malloy.
Jim Malloy was at the Indianapolis Speedway from 500 from 1968 through 71. Lost his life in 1972 on a day when he was clearly going to be on the front row. In fact, he was going to challenge Bobby Unser for the pole, but Jim Malloy was from Denver. And then his starts were 1968, 69, 70, and 71. And the best run by far was 1971 when he came with the Shelby team, Shelby Dowd. And they were having a bit of a struggle. And in fact, he was in several cars, and it looked like that he wasn't going to make the race. And I remember he said that he was out on the grass verge that used to go next to the pit wall and down the pit lane. And that's where the drivers would go out and kind of to be by themselves. And he said that... I got to know Jim Malloy pretty well, and he said, I was really down and thinking, we're going to miss the show. It was with MVS, and he said, we're going to miss the show. And he said, I was just just lying on the on the grass there, kind of staring at the ground, and I was aware of a shadow. And I looked up, and it was Dan Gurney. And he said, you want to give us a try? And they needed a driver because they'd come with Bobby Unser and Leroy Yarborough. And Leroy had a looked like it was going to be his best shot. And he had an accident in practice and a concussion, so he was out. And so anyway, Malloy took over and then finished fourth. And I remember that all the way through the winter of and certainly the the early part of the new year of 1972, he was really pumped because the new eagle, the new Dan Gurney Roman Slobodinsky designed eagle, a few people had those, and Bobby Unser was clearly, you know, all of the records were going to be shattered. And in early entire tests, Jim Malloy really thought that he had a shot at the pole. And then on a day I remember very well that had all kinds of problems. In fact, there was a tornado touching down on the east side. Now, everything at the speedway was okay. It was windy, but it was sunny. But we could look across to the east side to probably about Eastgate Shopping Center. And I didn't actually see a funnel cloud, but it looked pretty nasty over there. And I remember that the cars were in and out. They hadn't started qualifying yet. It was still practice session. And it was one of those really annoying situations where the green would come out. They'd go out, just do three, four laps, and then another yellow for a toe-in or something. And then Jim went out to do another hot lap or try and at least get one good one in, and then had a disaster up at the north end. But
again, Donald Davidson talking about Jim Malloy. When we come back, more on the 1972 Indianapolis 500, including a driver that happened to be one of the favorites of the late, great Bob Jenkins. We'll explain when we return to Beyond the Bricks.
If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
As a business owner, you're always learning. Hey, that's why you're listening to podcasts, am I right? And if you operate a business with multiple vehicles that travel Florida toll roads, you could be saving money with ePass. Not to mention, we have dedicated customer service reps who are standing by to answer any questions you may have, which saves you time. And time is money. Write that down. So visit getepass.com and sign up for an account today. And now, back to learning about KPIs, ROIs, COGs, and EBITDA.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson, brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
We are inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. It happens. Hire Hensley. Taking a look back at the 1972 Indianapolis 500-mile race. And Mike, I'm going to assume one of the top shows in that era, one that would go into syndication and live on for generations beyond just those in which it was initially intended. But I'm going to assume that at times you watched Scooby-Doo when you were a kid, correct?
I watched a little bit of Scooby-Doo as a kid, yeah. Yeah, for sure. Course, not a ton, but I did see it a few times.
You would know that the van they drove around in was the Mystery Machine, and that somewhat parlays into the next car we'll talk about. It was driven by Jerry Grant in the 1972 Indianapolis 500. Grant was trying to be a car owner. It wasn't working out, so he was doing what we often see, walking around with that helmet, just trying to find a ride. And he found it with that mysterious car, the Mystery Eagle. Jerry Grant, one that Bob Jenkins would always say was one of his favorite drivers. Donald Davidson with more on the Mystery Eagle.
The Mystery Eagle, that was the second Gurney Eagle. Jerry Grant was a teammate to Bobby Unser. And the sponsor was a fellow named Chris Fallow, who lived, and I'm trying to think exactly where. Ray Nichols was from, I think Highland was where the Nichols Engineering business was, in partnership with Paul Goldsmith. And Chris Fallow was called the Mystery Greek, and he supposedly had 150 companies, I think, and I really don't know what any of them were, but Chris Fallow was supposedly this multimillionaire that really got heavily into racing, and he was part of Ray Nichols' stock car team. I think David Pearson drove a car that was painted purple, but anyway, there was on the rear wing, the slogan, you name it, was on there. And a lot of people wondered what that meant. And I think what that meant was that Chris Fallow supposedly owned 150 companies. He did everything. What did he do? You name it. And I think that's what it was about.
Jerry Grant, by the way, would start 10 Indianapolis 500-mile races. And he not only was a driver that was around for a while that made him popular, but also his personality. Quick with a joke, if you will, which you can hear in this 1972 qualification coverage clip from ABC.
Then came Jerry Grant, the man who came here just the day before yesterday, and yesterday took his first laps in the number 48 car, the Mystery Eagle, so-called, of Dan Gurney. This is a sister car to the car that qualified fastest, the one of Bobby Unser. And Jerry Grant really got it going.
I think this is a great credit to Jerry and the car, because this illustrates, with so very few laps completed, perhaps only 20 laps practice, to go out and do a time like he did to post the fastest time of the day is in fact an achievement, and a great, I think, achievement for Dan Gurney and the car builder, because the mechanics obviously have done a great job. Jerry's been around a long time. He's been racing at Indianapolis a long time, and perhaps this year he's got the best chance of success that he's ever had. I think his friendship with Gurney is doing him a great deal.
Okay, this was Jerry Grant, who turned in a time of 189.145, fastest qualifying time of this day. But remember, he was not eligible to compete for the first spots and for the pole position. He was a second-day qualifier, and therefore is somewhere back in the middle of the field, or will be on race day. Jerry Grant, into the field. There he is.
Jerry Grant, what
That's
are you
the,
doing here? Your name wasn't on the entry list, and we haven't seen you until yesterday.
Well, I went out of business as a car owner, and I decided that either I was going to drive a competitive car or go dig ditches. And I got together with Dan, and I got the greatest opportunity of my life, and we're going racing.
What appeared to be a hat on Jerry's head is actually the protective mask the drivers wear nowadays, and he just kind of rolled it up after he finished. We'll be back in a minute at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway.
Jerry Grant would go on to race until 1976, each year, by the way, in the Indianapolis 500-mile race. Now, one of your favorite clips, I know, and one that still sometimes when you hear it, Mike, you say, did I hear that correctly, is a history lesson, and I'm using that in air quotes, from Chris Economaki, correct?
Yeah, this is one I actually just found not that long ago, and I'm not really sure how to describe it, because it starts off with this kind of unusual introduction from Keith Jackson, who was, you know, he was acting as the anchor on Bump Day that year, and he does his own sort of version of how the Speedway was built. And then there's this long piece from Chris Economaki. I mean, it was one of those filler pieces. And this thing is probably 10 minutes long. So I only cut part of it in there. But it ends in what I'm going to play ends in a pretty weird way, which we'll hear.
Back in 1909, a group of businessmen decided to have themselves a festival here. They put together a balloon race, and assorted other entertainment devices were brought in. And they had a good time. Then they decided they should have some car racing, so they added that. And in 1911, they decided to have a 500-mile automobile race, and they had one. It wasn't terribly successful from point of view in time, but then it was most successful, and from that has come what we have today, the Indy 500. So again, let's join Chris Economaki for a reflection on the post-war years of the Indy 500.
Then Jack Brabham appeared at the Speedway with a rear-engine car. He didn't know it, but he was starting a new trend. The former world champion placed in the top 10 with an underpowered car in a race that saw a wild accident on the main stretch. The car skidded and spun. Others dodged to the left and to the right. There were T-bone crashes, and then Jack Turner came upon the scene in the back, got sideways, hit the wall, and tumbled over and over. He walked away from this crash uninjured, as did all the other drivers. A.J. Foyt came back to win at a record speed, and then a youngster from California, Rufus Parnell Jones, arrived on the track in 1963. He was the first man to cover what is now an all-asphalt track at better than 150 miles an hour. J.C. Agajanian, who had a winner in 52, was hoping for great things in 63. The press in Indianapolis doesn't wait very long to show their headline. But the winner that year was Roger Ward. He is now an all-pro at the Speedway. A regular victory lane hand. Then Dan Gurney brought the Lotus rear engine car to Indianapolis, having a little bit of trouble here, but it was the beginning of still another trend. V8 engines in rear engine cars. Jack Turner had trouble qualifying what is now an old roadster on the track. He walked away from this accident and the sport of automobile racing as well, calling it quits after two straight flips. Eddie Sachs the next year tried to climb the wall in his car. This is now 1963. And Parnelli Jones dives down underneath and uses the grass to carry on to victory. The checkered flag goes over the only bricks on the circuit now, a 36-inch wide panel across the start-finish line, the rest of the speedway entirely covered by asphalt. Jim Clark zoomed from pole position to lead this race in 1965 in a British-made Ford-engined Lotus. Then, early in the going, a spin took place as Dave McDonald hit the inside wall. His car exploded. Eddie Sachs T-boned it head-on. The resultant holocaust cost both McDonald and Sachs their lives. But there was a plus to it, for it was at this point in time that fire suits were made mandatory, cars were made more safe, fuel cells were ordered mandatory on all cars, and a great emphasis on safety prevailed.
I don't know, Mike, that I would say that there's a plus to it. I guess you could say there is one thing that came out of that in the continued pursuit of safety. But to use the term a plus to it with that most horrific crash perhaps in race history, probably a bit of a miswording there by Chris Economaki, correct?
I believe so. I think that whole segment was a little weird because he's talking about Jim Clark leading in 65 when then he's talking about the 64 race, and then he goes back, you know, to saying it's 64 again, and then we have the accident, and then, yeah, I just thought the wording was so strange. These two people died a horrific death in front of thousands of people, but there was a plus to it.
Yeah, it was all of it, not to make light of that, but all of it was, that was kind of all over the place, right? Like, I had motion sickness.
It was.
Yeah.
Yeah,
no question
it was.
About it. Now, one driver that had problems as well in 1972 was Wally Dallenbach. He was bumped from the lineup on bump day, caught a ride replacing Art Pollard, who had been injured. Then on race day, he was really cooking. Literally, Donald Davidson on Dallenbach's month of May in 1972.
It was Wally Dallenbach. It's the car that Art Pollard had qualified, and then Pollard had an accident, broke his leg, and couldn't run. So they actually they were allowed to substitute a car. And Wally Dallenbach had got bumped. He was the first alternate starter. And so what they made an arrangement to put Dallenbach in the replacement car, not the one that he got bumped in, but a replacement car for the Pollard car, which was STP Corporation. And he would start 33rd regardless. And so it was Vince Granatelli, Andy's brother. The first stop, the fuel spilled, and they had the methanol fire, and they got the extinguishers, and he made four stops, and stops 1, 2, and 4 all had a fire, but the third stop went unscathed, and they did get a standing ovation, and on one of either the first or second stops, Vince's clothing was not fire retardant, and he had to get his his pants off in a hurry, and he was in jockey shorts, and there was something about they were either red hearts on white or something, but he had very, very colorful pants. And but then on the third one, which was resulted in no fire, and here's Dallenbach going back out into competition, and the crowd, great fans in the bleachers, all cheer, as you said, and then the Granatellis turned around, lined up, and then took a bow in as a chorus.
The Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network had their own coverage, of course, of Wally Dallenbach's race day misadventures. Here's how it sounded.
Out of the south pit, Lou Palmer. And doesn't it look smoky down here?
We have a... It's just reaching me now. The driver is all right. Let's set it in order as I cough through it. Wally Dallenbach is out of the car. It is the STP entry, the 40 car, Art Pollard's ride. He pulled into the pit about his 43rd, 44th lap, came in for what should have been a routine pit stop. They had it fueled up. He was ready to be pushed away, and suddenly, well, we could just begin to see the indication of alcohol vapor in the air around it, and wham, it had ignited. Well, Dallenbach climbed out of the car. He is all right. No scorch on the uniform. Everything seems fine, except the car, I suspect, has been or will be retired from the field itself. We don't know the reason for it. The fumes were most accurate, but they got it out quickly, and we've got no danger situation now at the moment. Dallenbach's anxiously looking over the car, hoping maybe there's something they can do. Seems unlikely. We'll keep you advised. Sid?
Thank you, and we said that we would tell Arthur Pollard what was doing with the car, and unfortunately that isn't the greatest news. I hope he doesn't suffer a relapse. But we're thinking about you, Art. It irks me so much, Lem, when I see some of the stories and hear people say, do people come to auto races to see action that harms somebody? I'm certain that's not true. The yellow's on. Here's Lou Palmer in the south pit.
I'm not sure this corresponds to your yellow, Sid, but we've got Wally Dallenbach bouncing out of that car again. Wally's all right, but it's on fire again. They're just not getting this pit stop worked out in the STP number 40 car. It is a new Lola, and this is the second time we've had it come up in flame, coming into the pit area now, one of the fire trucks itself. They've been using the CO2 extinguishers on it. Dallenbach's attempting to get them to stop now. He believes the fire's off, and they don't want to get any of that car loaded up with any more of this than they need to. Wally can't be a happy man, nor can Vince Granatelli, who is, by the way, fully clothed again in one of the fuel-changing uniforms down here. The last time, when finally they got the fire out, Vince was actually changing a wheel on that car before they moved it out on the track again in just a pair of jockey shorts. Now, Wally is looking into the cockpit of the car, and the question is, will we see it like before? The fire did not last as long this time. He may yet get back out on the track, but at the moment, the 40 car has a problem in the pit. Sid?
Just another example of how Lou Palmer was considered one of the all-time greats when it comes to his descriptions of pit road during his time with the Indianapolis Motor Speedway Radio Network. We come back, one of my favorite songs of the 80s, dare I say even a one-hit wonder. I'll explain what I mean next on Beyond the Bricks.
If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
When you've been in a crash and your mind's racing.
When you've fallen in a store and are blaming yourself.
When you've been hurt at work and you don't know what to do.
Or if you've been the victim of a medical mistake, we've got you.
We've got what it takes to prove a case that the insurance companies can't ignore.
With decades of experience and a track record of winning for our clients.
Farrah and Farrah, Orlando.
Beyond the Bricks with Jake Query and Mike Thompson. Brought to you by Quality Supply and Tool. Think outside the box. Store on 93.5 and 107.5 The Fan.
So again, we have a new track record. And now stay tuned for the greatest spectacle in racing.
This is the big country.
Out here, a special breed of men and a great breed of horses care for the needs of the livestock that feed the nation. The days are long and the action's fast. That's why Lone Star is one of the world's finest and lightest beers. To go all the way with the thirst a man gets when one's not enough. Lone Star, the beer every beer would like to be like. Lone Star.
Mike, one of my favorite songs from the 80s is In the Big Country by Big Country, and that's exactly what Lone Star makes you feel like you're at in the times when you just need that extra beer, right?
You got to give Lone Star credit, though. They had a lot of vivid word pictures that they portrayed, don't you think?
Well, and nothing says the speed of raising racehorses like dropping that into an ad for the Indianapolis 500-mile race, right?
That's right. You know, we live the big life and we have big horses and all this stuff. But yeah, I'm telling you, Lone Star, they did run a lot of spots back in the early 70s. And so I had to give you for 1972 tonight. Listen, anytime we can get a Lone Star spot, because, you know, the brand is Lone Star.
I will tell you, I do love me some Lone Star beer. I've had it before in the state of Texas, and it always just feels better when in Texas, which is, in fact, a whole other country. Jake Query, along with Mike Thompson, Landon Coons here as well, inside the Hensley Legal Group Race Command Center. It happens. Hire Hensley, taking a look back at the 1972 Indianapolis 500-mile race. One of the fan favorites always at Indy, of course, with the Bettenhausen family, Gary Bettenhausen in 1972. And it looked like it was going to be his day. He was running there up towards the front, looked like he had it. And then an issue inside of 20 laps to go, an ignition one for Gary Bettenhausen, who dropped out.
Okay, number four, and Jim Shelton.
Oh, you wouldn't believe it, but hard luck has apparently hit number seven there. He went by here very slowly, and I believe he will probably be down in the south chute right now.
Pick him up, Patty Bell.
All right, we were trying to reach you. The last two laps that Gary Bettenhausen has gone by, his engine is extremely sour. We took our headset off to get a closer listen, as we're only about 50 feet away from him. And his engine is sour, and he's up the backstretch now, but he is not at racing speed. Back to the tower.
How's he doing as he comes up to three? Can you pick him up, Ron?
He went by me just a moment ago, Sid, and that engine is quite sour. And as you may have guessed, Jerry Grant passed him here on three just about two laps ago. Sid?
Okay, well, watch him as he comes by here. I want to check the 170 laps, 425 miles. See Krizlov going out. We'll watch for Gary. And there he goes by, and you're certainly right. How much would you say he's slowed down, Len?
I would say that he's running about 90 miles an hour, just about yellow lap speed. And I would think that a turbocharger has gone out. That's usually what happens when you slow down about that speed. A turbocharger, which takes the bulk of the power away, and it's actually running on about 100 horsepower right now.
With Bettenhausen dropping out, the lead switched from a Gary to a Jerry, because Jerry Grant would take over the lead on lap 176. But then an unscheduled pit stop as well. What happened to Jerry Grant? So unscheduled that it didn't even take place in his own pit.
And also, I would say that Jerry Grant is getting some coaching from his crew, that Mark is closing down on him. Let's see if he can stretch that back out. I'm sure right now we're going to have a tremendous race from here to the finish.
One has to have a commercial someplace in a broadcast. Isn't it strange it would come just then? Jerry Grant has just come into the pit area for an unscheduled, unexpected pit stop. Lou Palmer, are you near him? Apparently not, so we'll watch him from here. He's back, being pushed back out again, and there he goes as Mark Donahue goes by.
I'm sure that Mark must be a lap up, though, that cost him a whole lap, because he was in there for 33 seconds, and I'm sure that as close as they were spaced together that there must be a full lap now between the two.
Remember that anecdote, by the way, about Grant missing his pit stop. More on that coming up. But the lead would then go over to Mark Donahue, and he would cruise his way home to victory.
Well, blue skies overhead and a beautiful blue car leading this thing. There he goes right now. He's into that home stretch, and boy, a big pocket full of greenbacks in his pocket. And here's Sid Collins.
And here he comes. And there's the checkered flag for Mark Donahue, winner of the 1972 Indianapolis 500-mile race. Now turning into victory lane is Mark Donahue, and standing by is Lou Palmer.
Right, we are down here, and we're awaiting him now. The pipes have begun, the Gordon Pipers, the crew is running down toward the car, and Mark Donahue's getting a final push. He's made it all the way home, and he is our winner in the Sunoco McLaren. Mark Donahue arrives. The crowd throngs around him. The congratulations being heaped upon him. A wreath of flowers paced on it. The BorgWarner trophy behind it. And a glass of milk also being prepared for Mark as soon as he gets out of that helmet. Finally, the full face helmet coming off. And Mark Donahue is surrounded by well-wishers here at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Mark Donahue is at his way today. We're looking for Roger Penske as well, who must be here in the crowd that is almost impossible to determine just who is at the car. I see Larry Truesdale over in the corner, Bud Poorman as well, helping him out. Now the garland of flowers being placed around the neck, and we're moving a little bit closer. I think behind the beard that may be James Garner over here as well. And Mark Donahue has arrived in victory lane, and the first kiss, I don't think, was from our queen, the 500 Festival Queen at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. Mark Donahue, sitting high at back of the car, his day today. Did you get, welcome home, Mark. It's been a fight, hasn't it?
Well, this is really the happiest moment of my life, and I really owe a lot to Carl Kienhoffer and Roger Penske and all the guys that worked so hard for to get to this point. We had some good luck, and it's kind of a change for us, I guess. But our whole team worked really well, and I just can't express how happy I am.
Okay, we're happy to have you here. And did the car, you were really racing at the end. It was almost like a sprint event, not a 500 mile. You and Grant were having something of a go out there. Did you know how close it was? And how about a sip of milk before you answer? Go ahead, Mark. Take a sip. All right. Hey, and you've got to be thirsty as well as happy. Another one. Have you met our queen?
Hi.
All right. Another reason to arrive in victory lane. Now, about that duel at the end, man, it really looked like it was pushing. You and Jerry, you were really racing each other out there. Were you aware how tight that contest was?
Well, yeah. Roger told me all along what was happening, and we'd kind of agreed to start racing a little bit towards the end of the race, and the car was pushing a bit, so we couldn't go as fast as we wanted, but unfortunately, I think Jerry had some little bad engine luck at the end, and that was a break for us.
How about the heat today? Was this a tiring race for you? You've had other 500 miles here.
Well, every race is a tiring race, but one is not very tired if he happens to win.
Mark Donahue started 5 races in the Indianapolis 500. He never started outside of the front 2 rows. He would return in 1973 again, starting in the 3rd spot, which is where he won from in 1972. But a piston issue would drop him out in that 73 race on lap 92. He was fatally injured in 1975, of course, of injuries in practice for the Austrian Grand Prix. Now, as for Jerry Grant, you heard Lou Palmer make reference to the fact that Grant finished 2nd in that race. He was the 2nd to come across and take the checkered flag behind Mark Donahue. But if you were to look at the box score, he is scored as 12th. Remember what we talked about earlier with that pit stop. Donald Davidson explains all of it.
He had already used up his fuel supply, and he was waved into the adjoining pit, which was Bobby Unser's, and Bobby Unser had gone out early, and supposedly the refueling mechanism from Bobby Unser's tank was hooked up to Jerry Grant's, and whether any fuel went in or not, he went out and finished the race, and he actually crossed the line 2nd behind Mark Donahue. Now, Jerry always contended that he won. He actually crossed the line 2nd. So when it was reported that they had gone into the Bobby Unser pit next to Grant's, and that the refueling mechanism had been hooked up, somebody of note on the team said, well, we didn't put any fuel in. Well, there was no way to know whether they did or not. And so Harlan Fengler disallowed the final 20. 12 laps, which dropped Grant from second to 12th, and then, of course, moved everybody else up one.
That would mean that Al Unser would technically finish second, followed by Joe Leonard, Sam Sessions, Sam Posey, Lloyd Ruby, Mike Hiss, Mario Andretti, Jimmy Carruthers, Cale Yarborough, George Snyder, and then Jerry Grant finishing in the 12th position. Back to Mark Donohue, the race winner, in the final minute here, Mike. He is one that I think had a precision at the Speedway that, unfortunately, due to his early passing, were Roger Penske's first win at the Speedway. I think people forget just how good Mark Donohue was.
No, I totally agree, Jake. I mean, he's a guy that there's a lot of fans of Mark Donohue out there, but, you know, it's a name that probably should be more known than it is. But Jerry Grant, I was going to tell you about this. He was, I told you before, he was a good friend of mine, and he used to sign autographs a lot of times on a picture of the Mystery Eagle. He would write 1972 Indy 500 winner and then put "no money" in parentheses because he felt like he still won the race, even though he didn't. But he would write that on fans' photos sometimes. I have a couple photos that he did that for me where he wrote 1972 winner, "no money."
Jerry Grant, again, one of the great characters and that sense of humor that we saw earlier. And another example of, at times, fortune and heartache and how they can all intertwine when it comes to the greatest race in the world. A lot of fun on this, the 15th of May, taking a look back at the 27th of May of 1972 and the Indianapolis 500-mile race. For Mike Thompson, for Landon Coons, who put it all together, my name is Jake Query, and we thank you for listening to Beyond the Bricks.
If you work with your hands, they don't care how you feel. You're sore, you're tired, and if the tool quits on you, you don't get to. That's the American way. And racing in Indianapolis, that's an American original. And so is Quality Supply and Tool. They're selling what works. They supply men and women who build this nation every day, not just on race day. So yeah, engines go wide open once a year, but if you're like us, you're wide open all the time. Next time you need supplies for a job, go to Quality Supply and Tool. Along with racing in Indianapolis, American originals.
Knowing your home or business is safe is what Safe Touch cares about most. And right now you can switch to Safe Touch for free. No hassle, just the best technology, seamless installation, and 24/7 monitoring. Plus, a free smoke detector. Call 888-723-8682 or visit safetouch.com. Free switch with signed 60-month agreement. $99 fee with 36-month agreement. Includes panel, translator, and smoke detector only. Certain restrictions apply. Offer ends February 28th. See safetouch.com for details. State license DF 2000-2049.